Put on this one. Okay, I'll just start my talk again. This is on the Revolution Betrayed, Chapter 4, which is the title "The Struggle for the Productivity of Labour." And this chapter, at first, when I reread it recently, when I first reread it, it appeared to lack some of the substance of some of the earlier chapters we've studied. It's been a long time since I read it, so I thought, I'd actually go ahead and reread it a couple of times to make sure I knew what I was saying. But I think the second time I reread it, I concluded that was a little bit of a mistake. It does actually contain some key insights into socialism and how society must progress towards socialism after the working class takes power, and the necessary economic content of the dictatorship of the proletariat. And it also contains key insights into what is the economic basis of the kind of deformations that afflicted the Soviet state in the period of the early Stalinist regime. And it points in embryo to how those deformations and problems led to the USSR's collapse much, much later, decades later. So it's not something you can really skip or treat lightly, I think. It's not a chapter you can dismiss. There are some very basic points about the economic content of a proletarian dictatorship at the beginning of the chapter. The different economic content of money and credit under such a regime, even or especially in conditions of relative economic backwardness, is a key insight. So Trotsky says on this, he says, the nationalization of the means of production and credit, the cooperative or statizing of internal trade, the monopoly of foreign trade, the collectivization of agriculture, the law on inheritance, all set strict limits on the personal accumulation of money and hinder its conversion into private capital, either usurious, commercial, or industrial. These functions of money, however, bound up as they are with exploitation, are not liquidated at the beginning of a proletarian revolution, but in a modified form and transferred to the state, the universal merchant, creditor, and industrialist. At the same time, the more elementary functions of money, as measures of value, of means of exchange, and medium of payment, are not only preserved, but acquire a broader field of action than they had under capitalism. So actually, this is in effect a defense of Lenin's of the original purpose of Lenin's new economic policy, and a polemic against the economic arbitrariness, which was a key feature both of war communism, which is the utopian period of the 1918 to 21 civil war, and their revival under Stalinism in the 1930s. The illusion that administrative measures can somehow jump over material reality and development is the key point here. There was a greater cynicism under Stalinism about this, as opposed to an earlier naivety about it in under war communism. And Trotsky elaborates some more on the role of money, providing it safeguarded as a reliable measure of value in spurring the development of the productive forces under the dictatorship of the proletariat. And what he says is that, I'll quote him again, says, the role of money in the Soviet economy is not only unfinished, but as we have said, still has a long growth ahead. The transitional epoch between capitalism and socialism, taken as a whole, does not mean cutting down of trade, but on the contrary, its extraordinary extension. All branches of industry transform themselves and grow. New ones continually arise, and all are compelled to define their relations to one another, both quantitatively and qualitatively. The liquidation of the consummatory peasant economy, and at the same time of the shut-in family life, means a transfer to the sphere of social interchange and ipso facto money circulation of all the labour energy that was formerly expended within the limits of the peasant's yard or within the walls of his private dwelling. All products and services begin for the first time in history to be exchanged for one another. It should be emphasized that this was not about money as the locus of profit making and the accumulation of surplus value. The whole point of the proletarian dictatorship is to suppress that as much as possible. But the role of the elementary functions of money, as he puts it, in overcoming pre-capitalist economic backwardness in de and developing the productive forces under a statified economy is crucial. And he noted that a stable currency as an accurate measure of value by labour time was the only way to promote real involvement of the masses and material incentives to increase production. So he pointed out that a socialist construction is unthinkable without including in the planned system the direct personal interests of the producer and consumer, their egoism, as it were, which in its turn may reveal itself fruitfully only if it has the serve in its service the customary and reliable flexible instrument, money. The raising of the productivity of labour and the bettering of the quality of its products is quite unattainable without an accurate measure freely penetrating into all the cells of industry, that is, without a stable unit of currency. And he makes a point about the gold standard, which I think may be a bit of a product of its time. In that period in the 20s and 30s, it was the dominant wisdom of capitalist economics that the gold standard was the fundamental basis of money. But it has actually turned out since that at times similar things have happened without the gold standard, and nevertheless, that even the bourgeoisie have made major productive gains without it at times. So I think that point is actually debatable, but it should be clear that what Trotsky was not advocating here was anything like market socialism. It wasn't. It was entirely. His point was entirely consistent with the critique of by the left opposition in the late 20s of Stalin and Bukharin for pandering to the kulaks, the well-to-do peasants. The left opposition at the in that period was demanded a measured program of collectivization of agriculture through material and moral incentives, linked to a more general program of measured but consistent and planned industrialization. So the opposition was advocating the drawing up of comprehensive plans at the time the Stalin-Bukharin bloc was still cassetting the kulaks, and Bukharin, with Stalin's approval, was calling on the peasantry to enrich themselves. And during that period, the left opposition were denounced as super industrializers before the kulaks declared war on the Soviet regime and they split the Stalin-Bukharin bloc, forcing Stalin to defend Soviet power by panic measures of civil war and forced collectivization, which was not good, of course, but it was clearly the lesser evil to Bukharin in those circumstances. So, Trotsky's critique in this slightly later period was for playing fast and loose with the currency and its ability to be used as a reliable measure of value. That's actually key to his critique of this economic adventurism. He documents the destruction of Lenin's gold shervonets. The shervonets was the new ruble that was introduced by the Bolshevik regime during the NEP period. He documents that Stalin effectively destroyed that by printing of money to finance forced collectivization, and that had some quite ruinous consequences on the masses. So he says that he quotes quoting him again. He says, "So long as the course towards the well-to-do farmer continued, the shervonets was an object of governmental concern. During the first period of the 5-year plan, on the contrary, all the sluices of inflation were opened. From 0.7 billion rubles at the beginning of 1925, the total issue of currency had risen by the beginning of 1928 to the comparatively modest sum of 1.7 billions. But the subsequent curve of inflation from year to year is depicted in the following feverish series. 2.0 goes to 2.8, goes to 4.3, goes to 5.5, goes to 8.4. The final figure of 8.4 billion rubles was reached at the beginning of 1933. So he noted the concentrating efforts of the regime to pretend that this really meant nothing, that it was a sign of the genius, in quotes, of Stalin's planners, etc. And there were attempts to criminalize people who talked about inflation being a problem. So Trotsky complained more. He wrote that the bureaucracy was sending to the devil the NEP, which means the money evaluation of all goods, including labor power. Restoring bourgeois norms with one hand, they were actually destroying with the other hand the sole implement of any use under them. And the effect on this on the working class was disastrous. It's needless to say that the inflation represented a dreadful tax upon the working masses. And likewise, in agriculture, the economic arbitrariness led to disasters in the countryside. So he spells it out again. He says that the immediate consequence was not only an extermination of more than half of the livestock, but more important, a complete indifference of the members of the collective farms to the socialized property and the results of their own labor. The government was compelled to make a disorderly retreat. They again supplied the peasants with chickens, pigs, sheep, and cows as personal property. They gave them private lots adjoining the farmsteads. The film of collectivization began to run off backwards. The daily needs of the average peasant are still met to a greater degree by his work on his own than by his participation in the collective. The peasant's income from individual enterprises, especially when he takes up technical culture, fruit or stock farming, amounts frequently to three times as much as the earnings of the same peasant in the collective economy. And the regime was therefore forced to retreat, not only in agriculture, but also more generally. So he notes that. In quoting again, he says that after that came the years of reconsideration of retreat. 6.9 went to 7.7, went to 7.9 billion. That's in 1935. That's a slowing down of the rate of printing money, at least, The ruble of 1924, equaling the official exchange to 13 francs, had been reduced in 1935 to 3 francs. That is to less than a fourth of its value, or almost as much as the French franc was reduced as a result of the war. Both parties, the old and the new, are very conditional in character. The purchasing power of the ruble in world prices now hardly equals 1.5 francs. Nevertheless, the scale of devaluation shows with what dizzy speed the Soviet valuta, that is the currency, was sliding downhill until 1934. And his criticisms of the illusions promoted by the Stalinists of administrative prices are very sharp. And he notes that, quoting again, the obedient professors managed to create an entire theory according to which the Soviet price, in contrast to the market price, has an exclusively planning or directive character. That is, it is not an economic but administrative category, and thus serves the better for the redistribution of the people's income in the interests of socialism. The professors forgot to explain how you can estimate real costs if all prices express the will of a bureaucracy and not the amount of socially necessary labour expended. And they were forced to do a U-turn on this. Their attempts to substitute ration cards for money were abandoned. And he quotes the head of the State Planning Commission saying that basically the present system of mutual relations between the banks and industry must be revised, and the banks must seriously realize control by the ruble. And again, when they did that, just as with the NEP, the results were actually positive. And he goes through it again. He says, well, The growth of commodity circulation under the restored market has become very rapid. Paper money inflation was actually stopped in 1934. The elements of a certain stabilization of the ruble exist. Nevertheless, the announcement of the People's Commissar of Finance must be explained to a considerable extent by the inflation of optimism. If the Soviet ruble possesses a mighty support in the general rise of industry, still its Achilles heel is the intolerably high cost of production. The ruble will become the most stable valuta, that is, currency, only from the moment when the Soviet productivity of labor exceeds that of the rest of the world, and when consequently the ruble itself will be meditating on its final hour. With a firm rejection of inflation in the future, the currency, though deprived of the advantage of the gold standard, could indubitably help to cure the many deep wounds inflicted on the economy by the bureaucratic subjectivism of the previous years. And again, when Trotsky talks about the market, he's not talking about a market for capital or anything like it, but rather about a system of exchange of the products of state industry and collectivized agriculture based on a relatively stable currency. And that's one where exchange, mediated by such a stable currency, is of goods and products mediated by their values, as opposed to, as expressed in labor time, as the basis for the building up of the productive power of the economy in a rational and commensurable way, not with arbitrary prices based on the illusions giving birth to unpredictable economic surprises. And that brings us on to the final section of the chapter, of course, which is about the Stakhanov movement. If people know what that was, it was the movement whereby certain workers were were said to have produced incredible feats of productivity, and were rewarded and given heroic status, etc. He writes about that. He writes about the Stakhanov movement and the tendency of the Stalinist regime to vacillate, sometimes quite rapidly, between utopian administrative measures to try to speed up growth and brutal capitalist-derived methods. So you had shock brigades, which were ostensibly socialist, and then Stakhanovism, which, with its trumpeted and no doubt considerable achievements of productivity by particular individuals, was actually based on piecework, which is actually the most extreme form of the capitalist labor process, as it's rightly rejected by many workers as a crude carrot and stick method of coercing the working class to potentially damage its own future labor capacity through overwork. And these are the worst methods of labor discipline, which the workers' movement in capitalist countries often fought against for this reason. And there's nothing socialist about it. And Trotsky was harshly critical of it being portrayed in that way. And yet he was not dismissive of the idea that there could be some element of socialist aspirations and consciousness, and also a subordinate element of the effect of planning as a method in driving some of its achievements. I think this is in itself an element of the contradictory nature of the USSR under Stalinism. Different elements, some involving backwardness, could combine with advanced tendencies of planning and its socialist potential to produce something with unique elements. However, whatever potential may have existed in this, the bureaucracy's instability and its arbitrariness was a barrier. So, just to quote him directly again, he notes that certain achievements of individual workers are undoubtedly extremely interesting as evidence of the possibilities open only to socialism. However, from these possibilities to their realization on the scale of the whole economy is a long road. With the close dependence of one productive process on another, a continual high output cannot be the result of mere personal efforts. The elevation of the average productivity cannot be achieved without a reorganization of production, both in the separate factory and in the relations between enterprises. Moreover, to raise millions to a small degree of technical skill is immeasurably harder than to spur on a few thousand champions. And that was the principal consideration. The implementation of this, even then, was tainted with arbitrariness and irrationality. So he, quoting again, he says that the first steps of the movement were signaled with mass repressions against the technical and engineering personnel, of workers accused of resistance, sabotage, and in some cases even the murder of Stakhanovists. The severity of repressions testifies to the strength of the resistance. The bosses explain this so-called sabotage as political opposition. In reality, it was most often rooted in technical, economic, and cultural difficulties, a considerable portion of which found their source in the bureaucracy itself. And the consequences often even squandered the potential benefits of the bourgeois methods that were employed. He notes that as a result of the Stakhanovist days and 10-day periods, complete chaos was introduced into many enterprises. This explains the fact, at first glance astonishing, that a growth in the number of Stakhanovists is frequently accompanied not with an increase, but a decrease in the general productivity of the enterprise. And he made clear that the underlying reason for the problem is not the backwardness of the working class per se, but the arbitrary nature of the bureaucracy and its backwardness and its vacillations. So just to quote Trotsky again, finally, he wrote that the leaders themselves, as we have heard, complain at times that the Soviet workers lack skill. However, that's only half the truth, and the smaller half. The Russian worker is enterprising, ingenious, and gifted. Any 100 Soviet workers transferred into the conditions of, let us say, of American industry, after a few months or even weeks, would probably not fall behind the American workers of a corresponding category. The difficulty lies in the general organization of labor. The Soviet administrative personnel is, as a general rule, far less equal to the new productive tasks than the worker. And that's a strategic question, really, the role of the bureaucracy and what is to be done about it. Future chapters of The Revolution Betrayed will actually address this in more address this in depth, but I'm going to stop there because I think that really does actually finish the basic subject matter of the chapter, and we will go on to those questions later. So that's me for now, and I'll open it up to discussion. Cheers.
Can I say something?
Marie, yes, certainly.
Yeah. Does anybody else want to speak? Right, nobody else. So yeah, I'll give it a go. Well done, Ian. This is showing how it wasn't possible to make socialism like Stalin was saying. We have socialism and communism is round the corner. Well, the sad thing, the terrible thing about that is that if you didn't agree with this, he sent you, he exiled you or put you in prison and got you dispatched. I note that in the period when this was written, Trotsky was being he was being thrown out of Norway. He was being deported. And he was looking for places where to go. Imagine he was having his head in all these details, and yet he was having this fight in his life. And then eventually Mexico said they would have him. So in the same year, beginning the end of the 36, beginning 37, he was in Mexico. But all this was traumatic. And yet look at the beautiful stuff. How he kept informed and how he kept into the detail of what was going on. I'm just going to go back to a few points just to highlight perhaps. So the struggle for the productivity of labor, I think the conclusion which is drawn at the end is that You cannot, the leadership cannot decide we are going to distribute the wealth of the country the way we like, because there is an economic structure which puts a limit to the quantity and the quality of what can be distributed. And this is a key point which was dealt by Marx. Eventually, this is mentioned here. Marx had a whole book. Was it a Gotha program? A critic of the Gotha, something like that. This is a thing which required a lot of knowledge and Marxist knowledge, which Stalin had not never cared for. He was not a theoretician, and he was very crude and even religious in his method of thinking. About the struggle for productivity of labor, then this would be a conclusion that this bureaucracy was trying to take the control of the currency, as part of the state, as if somehow it could be willed, it could be wished to behave in a certain way. But if the currency is not based on value, and Trotsky was suggesting the gold, and I believe that in the beginning there had been a gold base during the Tsar to the currency. If the currency is not based on gold, you don't or on something which is a reference. You don't have a measure from which to plan progress and to stop bureaucratic abuse. There was the Soviet economy, he said, is dynamic. It's continually transforming technically. It's capable of large-scale experiments because now when things are nationalized, you can plan. But the more it progresses in that way, the more it needs a stable measure of value. And so I think this is it links with the question of inflation. You have shown the terrific inflation that was going on, Ian, particularly from 1925 to 33. And then there was another phase from 33 to 36 when the bureaucracy tried to do something about it. In the first period, 25 to 33, printing money kept going until the ruble could not buy anything abroad. This was economic adventurism in full flight, says Trotsky. Since 1918, people had got bread and food through the food card, a card that gives you entitlement to food. This was not a merchant sale, said the bureaucracy. This is not an act of merchant, but direct socialist distribution. And so was the bureaucracy pretending that we were in socialism. But the money is only a conventional label of the planned economy, namely the universal distribution card. The stable prices were designated by the state. This is what the bureaucracy thought. Socialism had triumphed finally and irrevocably, said Stalin. The state had taken command of the currency, giving it an arbitrary purchasing power. And the purchasing power, of course, I think this needs stressing, was greater for those with the power. So it was not that there was chaos. It was an organized chaos, which was in which those in power were doing well for themselves. In practice, inflation was a tax upon the workers. Industries was continuing its rapid growth, but with a non-efficiency which was counterproductive economically, with low-grade foods, wild prices, and no link between remuneration and the level of personal interest taken in the way of producing a good. And most of all, the tremendous inequality that this was enabling. In 1933, Stalin had declared that inflation was not inconsistent with the Soviet system. So after having repressed all sorts of comrades who said that there was inflation, if you talked about inflation, you could be taken to prison. In 1933, Stalin declares that inflation is not inconsistent with the Soviet system. So then, He keeps on with the same conception, even though he's forced to make the changes which Ian has talked about. For example, there was this in the countryside, creating a collective farm aristocracy. So a private plot was given to some agricultural workers who were on the collective farms, so that they could build a little company on the side, on a little piece of land which was outside the collective. And Trotsky says about this, it was a barbarous squandering of millions of human forces, especially those of women, in midget enterprises, because they were small little things. And still the extremely low productivity of labor continued on the collective farms. That was an aspect of it. I think that we looked at 31 to, we looked at 25 to 33. From 31 to 36, for example, paper inflation was stopped during that period. Now inflation is recognized, but those who name and recognize it are still being silenced and repressed. In January 36, the economic relations in the city and the country, the relations of those places to the state and between each other, were translated now into the language of money, because you couldn't speak about inflation, but money had become a concern. This marked the end of the superstition, so Trotsky says. This marked the end of the superstition of administrative plan and the illusion of administrative prices. I would like now to go to the conclusions, but there's much, much more to be said. I would want to drive two conclusions. Trotsky says the gradual dying away of the state, which had been envisaged by by Marxism, ought to begin under socialism. Surely, this is what socialism is about. But if it doesn't, if it doesn't, the state doesn't die away, but on the contrary, acquire even the control of the currency and of the economic transaction, you don't have socialism. And you cannot, how can you say that we have socialism and then there's all this going on? And then there is another thing. Another conclusion I have highlighted, money remains a necessity in this transitional economy. As Ian said, it needs to be based on gold or on some security if it is going to acquire an independent way of measuring itself internally and internationally. The new country will only survive if it can hold its own against the highest achievements of the world market. So all this in a backward country, all this transformation is taking place in the teeth of competition with others, because you have to trade. You just cannot stop trading, and so you are in front of the world market. And what you have to confront is the most advanced on the world market. If an economy is rational, it should be able to do this. So this is my comment. My view, capitalism is irrational. This is why any worker state will be superior to capitalism. This is my conclusion. If you produce efficiently and save working time, you improve the material well-being and allow a higher flowering of culture. And then I want to say finally, this was an experience which took place at a time in history when this was the only worker state, when it was one of the most backward countries of the world, when that country had been devastated several times in 1914, then again in the Civil War, and then previous to that, the Russia had been devastated and devastated and kept under control by world capitalism, and yet this is where revolution took place and managed to bring a solution to feudalism through a leap over capitalism. I think this is a tremendous experience for humanity, and it was retaken by China a few years later, and then by Cuba and Vietnam, all these countries of Africa which come out of tribalism and go straight, like Ethiopia, Mozambique. They made that leap. They never produced a capitalist state. in those countries. And I think it was not just the qualities and capacity of the leaders, but the incapacity of capitalism to develop itself. And it seems to me that we could already see at the time of 1917 that capitalism was not giving any prospect of development to Russia. On the contrary, they were hated, and I don't know how many countries were there to defeat the revolution, to smash the revolution, which means that they had no prospect of developing a capitalist system. And it's taking a long time, it's taking decades, but we are going towards the end of capitalism. Yeah, that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Sorry, who wants to speak? Sorry, I was muted then. Anybody want to speak?
They could ask questions, couldn't they?
Yeah, anybody got any questions or contributions or whatever?
There was that thing about the Chevronettes.
The
Did you want to
Sherman.
explain a little bit what that was,
Yeah,
maybe?
certainly. It was the gold ruble that was introduced about 1923 or something like that. I can't quite remember the exact date. But basically, during the period of war communism, which was a period of between the beginning of the Civil War in 1918 to the end of the Civil War, they basically printed money. Printed the Soviet ruble, as it the early Soviet ruble was basically just paper, and it was printed in enormous quantities and used to pay people and to as the economic basis of the Civil War regime and of fighting off the imperialist invaders. But it became very, very clear at the end of the Civil War that this was just totally chaotic, and it didn't really measure it. The amount in circulation was, I think it was something like quadrillions of rubles, which is a huge amount of money. It's one with I don't know how many. I think it's more. It's more than. It's one with 16 zeros behind it. I think that's the. Of what it means actually, which is an incredible amount of that of denomination value, totally impractical, and it had to be replaced as a matter of urgency, and it was replaced. The NEP introduced the gold ruble. And I don't know exactly what the ratio was, but it was huge. And it cut down that the you know it was stable because it was based on gold, and that was a key measure of economic stabilization that was in the new economic policy that was introduced after 1921 by the Bolsheviks to actually it was a retreat. It was a retreat from the it was a retreat from the regime in the Civil War. It was an acknowledgement that they were a backward country and they couldn't just simply jump over economic development into socialism. They could you can't you know the problem with this the regime the idea of socialism in one country has so many implications, and one possible implication is that you can plan your way into socialism, in the confines of a backward country. So even within the ideology of Stalinism, you can see the basis. The socialism in one country. You can see the basis for arbitrary economic decisions, and because socialism is an advanced productive economy that's superior to capitalism in its productive capacity and its culture and a whole range of different criteria. And of course, the idea that you could actually have that in one backward country has so many implications in terms of. Possible arbitrary decisions, possible declaration that such and such a thing represents socialism, when in fact it represents nothing of the sort. And that's what did happen under Stalinism repeatedly. And that's what this sort of con this chapter sort of captures that in a way, the continual vacillation between ultra-capitalist methods like peace work, and things that profess to abolish or lessen the role of money, in the economy, goes backwards and forwards from one extreme to the other because they haven't got the correct orientation, which is basically we are a backward country. We cannot leap over material reality. We can only work with it to a degree, while the revol while we struggle for a more general world revolution, that the Shevardnadze was a partial negation of that. It was the creation of a gold ruble, a stable currency, and that was very important to the Bolsheviks in the period of NEP. But it was probably fetishized to a degree by the Stalin Bukharin regime. But as soon as they panicked at the revolt, they allowed the kulaks to become too strong. When the kulaks rebelled against the Soviet regime, the Stalinists split from Bukharin and effectively attempted again to jump over material reality in so many ways. The Shevardnadze was something of an antidote to that, but and its fate, the fact that it was virtually inflated away in the early 30s, and then they attempted to restabilize the currency in the mid 30s, is indicative. They had to retreat from some of the crazy things they tried to do. Anybody else?
Paul wants to speak.
Who wants to speak? Paul. Yeah, okay, Paul. Sorry,
Good
you're off my
question.
screen. That's what. That's better. Paul, you want to speak?
Get the question. Remind me, what did MPC, what did NEP stand for?
New economic policy.
Okay, thanks.
It's actually the retreat from war communism, administrative sort of running of the economy by decree, by the Soviets of by the Council of People's Commissars. They could decree the planning of the economy and primarily for war purposes, for the purpose of winning the Civil War. But they had to retreat from that, and the NEP was the retreat. And they allowed, as well as stabilizing the currency, they allowed a degree of capitalist latitude for, particularly in the countryside, to a degree. Limited, strictly limited, but nevertheless, they allowed people to employ labour to some extent and on a small scale, and to exchange on the basis of value and not on the basis of administrative prices. Paul wants to speak again, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, with regards to that, with regards to collectivization of farms, my understanding from the previous chapter was that the regime tried to do it all too quickly, and that led to the rebellion of the peasants, and in turn led to basically reintroduction of elements of capitalism to keep the peasants on side. Have I remembered that correctly, or have I kind of well, that's my question really.
I'm not sure that I think the rebellion of the peasantry was not really caused by them trying to do things too quickly. I think in some ways it was caused the opposite. It was caused because they basically encouraged the peasantry to become more powerful in the rich peasantry to become more powerful, that is, in the illusion that that would help in the building of socialism, And it was called building socialism at a snail's pace. And what they were actually doing is enriching themselves and making themselves more powerful, and and therefore acquiring the means to actually rebel against any sort of restriction on them at all, And that's what they tried to do in the late 20s, in about 1928. You saw grain strikes by the organized by the kulaks, against so that they would say, we will if the cities are going to be fed, it will be done on our terms, not by the state planning commission or anything, The state will have nothing to do with it. It'll be done purely by the market and purely by our buying and selling. That's what they wanted to do, but of course that threatened the Soviet regime, didn't it? So it forced the split between Stalin and Bukharin. Bukharin wanted to carry on conciliating the peasantry, the rich peasantry, that is, Well, Stalin actually was frightened by it, into taking some very drastic bureaucratic actions against them, which were partly justified, partly, but not in the way they were actually carried out, So Marie wants to speak again.
Yeah, just about what you said. I think there's a little paragraph in our document which shows the ludicrous situation when the one who is the snail and the one who is the super industrializer, they change sides. So the period. Do you want to explain that, Ian, a bit
No,
better?
carry on, carry on, carry on. I've spoken too
Yeah.
much, to be honest.
Yeah, I have a go at trying to explain it. So, in the period that you just mentioned, Ian, when the Kulag were encouraged to become rich, then Trotsky was saying he was impatient that the leadership of the country should hurry to stop this process. And the snail was he described Stalin as reluctant, and therefore he didn't want to do anything. Therefore, he was like a snail. He was going at a snail pace. But now, in the thing that we have discussed, well, we find that in the panic of Stalin, he has become the super industrializer, and the snail is that right now? The snail is supposed to be Trotsky, who posed that things have got to go slower and to be taken in their stride, and that you cannot invent an economy, that you have got to enter all the ins and outs of its difficulty in its transition period. Perhaps did I do that right?
Yeah,
But
sounds fine for me.
it was ludicrous because the roles were reversed.
Yeah, they became super industrializers, but in a way that was jumping over the so-called super industrializers were quite actually cautious about what could be done, and they wanted a gentle steer towards industrialization and collectivization, not a sudden civil war imposition of it by force, it was a measured policy. It was not an all or nothing immediate big bang type thing. That's what Stalin actually attempted to do at the in the 5-year plans after a certain point. That was not the aim. It was meant to happen smoothly, not as a sudden. But of course they were opposed to it. So Stalin and Bukharin were opposed to it, so it didn't happen. And it was never attempted even, and so it was too late.
And isn't it the case that in any case, with the best of leaders, even with Trotsky, there would have been tremendous problems.
Yes, absolutely.
But what actually was so unacceptable is that the bureaucracy was looking after itself very well, meanwhile, all this. And they were all privileges and They were developing all sorts of, they wanted to be as, prosperous looking as in the West. And the very stupid, women wanted fur coats and they were going to Paris to buy fur coats. And then all that when the peasants, if you had a remuneration at work or on the collective farm, you had, you were not sure that you would even get, you didn't know what you were going to get, and you didn't know what the prices would be in the shops. And so there was tremendous hardship and heartache. And the workers worked a thousand times more than necessary to pull this stupid cart. And this is what is so objectionable. It's not so much that it was difficult, and we understand, but that it's a bureaucracy which is not to be understood.
Sure. Anybody else want to speak? Sorry. Carry on if you've not quite finished.
Sorry, I had finished, but mind you, there would have been a bureaucracy anyway, because you cannot. The attitude of wanting to appropriate in front of shortage is not something which disappears because power has been taken. I think this is another thing to remember. To take power doesn't mean suddenly we have equality. It means that now we can discuss the repartition, the objective and equitative distribution. But in front of any difficulty, you will always have a layer, particularly those who are in distribution, who look after themselves first. And it's not necessarily something, it wouldn't have been avoided by a Lenin or by Trotsky, I don't think.
Just on that, I mean, I think you're right in the sense that the bureaucracy, I mean, this is where we start to come on to the next chapter and some of the stuff in the next chapter. But yeah, the bureaucracy was objectively necessary. It had to exist because the bourgeois norms had to be maintained in order for the economy to produce anything. But what you didn't need was when the bureaucracy had actually seized power from the proletariat. The bureaucracy became the master of the house and not the servant, you know. You needed an apparatus to do these things, but you didn't need it to take power off to seize power for itself. And that was the product of the isolation and the revolution, really. You can't do without it until you've actually overcome the backwardness that gave rise to it. But what you can do is try to is prevent it from becoming the master of the house, as it were. Oh.
I mean, I think we here have all read it, but just in case those who haven't, that's basically what George Orwell's Animal Farm was about, isn't it? It's basically where the revolution happened, and then the bureaucracy just becomes the new ruling class, isn't it? That continues to enrich itself. But I'm sure everyone here has already read it.
Yeah. I'm not that keen on that book because it sort of implies that it's inevitable and that any attempt to overthrow the established order will end up with the people who do it becoming the same as the those they overthrew. And that's the problem with Orwell. He became.
I didn't read it that way, but it did serve as a warning that there's always that possibility that there is always going to be that class antagonism until the economic
Yeah, well, that is true.
situation has got to a certain point, and then of course you've got to introduce a system whereby that is able to withstand a counter revolution, which is why dare I say it, which is why you can't just jump to anarchism. I know anarchism isn't about our subject, but I know some people in our group idealize that sort of thing. But you've got to start with the material basis, and I understood Animal Farm to give me a warning of what could happen. I don't think it was suggesting it was inevitable, but it is a caricature. Each character in that is a caricature of the regime, if I remember correctly. Thanks.
Anybody else?
I was going to say, I don't remember seeing it, but there was any mention in that paper about the West sabotaging things, getting in under the skin, and were they aware of it if that was actually happening? I'm sure it was, wasn't it? As far as I remember.
Well, it always was. Yeah.
Yeah, the West were actually interfering and letting off bombs in places and trying to counteract what was going on. Was that true?
Well, yes, it is true. The West were actually the various capitalist powers were always intriguing against the Soviet Union. There's no doubt about it. You know, they were always looking for ways to undermine it or whatever. That is true. I mean, that will always be true when you have a workers' state. You know that, but that doesn't really sort of, you know, that's a given. You know, we have to deal with that problem, or we'll always have to deal with that problem until we vanquish the ruling classes internationally. But that doesn't really explain some of the things that went on in the degeneration of the revolutionary, because that's what you the revolutionary movement has to find ways to combat that, you know, and it will, you know, it has done at times, you know. But there are other problems that are being addressed in this, really, you know. Paul, you wanted to say some more?
Yeah, just on that, I mean, Mark's question does actually lead to not the question itself, but about the way the West behaved against the Soviet Union. Some Stalinists actually used that to justify the way the Stalinist regime behaved. But I think most of us here would agree that in itself is not an excuse, is it?
It actually made it worse. You know, I mean, the classic case is Stalin's relationship with Hitler. You know, Stalin, I mean, this is going on a bit to a point period later in history, but Stalin did actually, you know, people say that the only person that Stalin ever trusted in his life was Hitler, and he was the wrong person to, you know, it really was appalling, you know, the fact that Stalin was completely taken by surprise by what happened in June 1941, and literally refused to believe it. This is so we hear, you know. If that's true, and I believe it is true, then that's an appalling indictment of the fact that the irrationality of the regime led to crackdowns on the left, on left-wing critics, but at the same time they trusted their enemies, and that is built into the theory of the understanding of socialism in one country, really, you know. To some level, to do that, you have to trust your enemies, because you actually have to coexist with them, you know, and it leads to that sort of. I mean, there are other examples, you know. That is just the worst, you know, the relations of the bureaucracy with class enemies around the world. You know, there's certainly could give you a long list of of things that they did that were really quite appalling, and their softness on some terrible enemies of the revolution, you know. Sorry, Clive, you want to speak? Yeah. You're muted, that. You're still muted. Can't hear you.
That's better.
Yeah.
I'm muted again, aren't I?
Yeah, you are. Yeah. And you still are. You still are. Click it. That's it.
Oh,
Yeah,
that's
I think
interesting.
you remuted yourself after you unmuted.
Must have done. Yes, I was thinking it's not so much time for more words, from my point of view, anyway. It's more time for a song. which you can join in if you like. Leon Trotsky was a Nazi, and we know it for a fact. First we heard it, then we read it in the Stalin-Hitler Pact.
Oh, indeed.
No, it's not right, is it?
It's almost right.
No, this is idealism. The idealism, which is the opposite of materialism, the abandonment of Marxism. So, the bureaucracy, you have that in the trade unions. They give credit to the bosses when it's bloody clear that they are going to close the company. And, Gorbachev did that. He thought that NATO was not going to expand. But it was clear that it would happen, and there was no need to have even read Karl Marx to know that. And this is idealism, and idealism leads to an attitude of concession and alignment with the forces of the action.
Anybody
It's a
else?
bit
I said
different.
Paul wants to speak. Yes, yeah,
Marie just led me on to another point. I know some of us in our both groups, and I know this is diverging from the text somewhat, but some of us in our both groups have talked about the idea of a multipolar world, and some of us in our own way are quite enthusiastic about BRICS against some of the imperialist forces, i.e. America, Britain and others. However, Marie mentioned the material basis of the world. We mustn't forget that those countries in BRICS
Coming, Julia.
are, we mustn't forget that some of the countries, we mustn't forget the countries in BRICS are still operating under capitalism. So even if they are acting as a what's the word, a break or a stopgap against the imperial countries, there's always a danger that one or more could become the next imperialist. So we have to keep that in mind and not get too enthusiastic about some of these other countries, because somebody would argue that some of these countries, such as China, are imperialist in other ways, if not necessarily militarily. So I just wanted to make that point, since Marie mentioned the term materialism. Thanks.
Anybody else?
But Diana made good points. She says that Stalin trusted everybody,
It is true.
except that he didn't trust any of the people ever around him and got all of them killed. So.
It's the classic syndrome of the bureaucracy, isn't it? The Labour bureaucracies, they always trust the class enemy more than they really do not like the militants who actually have a anti-capitalist program of their own. You know, that's what they really do not like. The Labour, you know, that's the Soviet bureaucracy that crystallised was actually similar to a Labour bureaucracy, and this actually just shows the same mentality, you know. It's not a new ruling class, though. It's that's a different argument, I think, you know. But it does have the mentality of a Labour bureaucracy, and I think that's what was you know, you're right. You can see it in trade union bureaucracy, the way trade union bureaucrats grovel to the bosses so often, you know. It's a characteristic way of thinking, really, of such people, you know, of that social layer. Whether it has state power or is simply part of a, you know, simply heads of trade union in the capitalist country.
Oh, hello, Diana.
Oh.
Perhaps you want Diana wants to say more.
Yeah, Diana wants to speak, yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. I haven't got much to say, really. Yeah, isn't it about the bureaucracy, trade union bureaucracies? As long as you've got any organisation that has some kind of hierarchy and people above others, controlling others, you always get exploitation. See, it seems that so that's what's happening in our current labour mu movement and the trade unions. They just because of their hierarchical structure, they just do not represent the workers' interests. They just represent the interests of going up the hierarchy. And it strikes me that after the Russian Revolution, Stalin was a bit of a despot anyway, but they just the people in trying to run the whole thing and get it to work just couldn't shake off that kind of hierarchical culture. You got trapped by it.
Yeah.
So, with all this going on, how did they manage to drag millions out of poverty? Was that too basic a question?
Let Paul speak and I'll come back on that if you like.
I've got a slightly counter argument with regard to today's trade union movement. I take Diana's point about the bureaucracies of the various unions. That's true. However, a lot of people in the trade unions, although they're members, a lot of them are not actually actively involved. So, to some extent, the working class, in many respects, make it work for themselves by not actually taking part in their own union's activities in many respects. So, I don't know if that's unique to the UK or whether the trade union movement is a bit like that elsewhere, but I did notice that, I'm in the United Community, which isn't actually an industrial union, but it's still part of the union movement. And but you get to a general secretary election every every few years, and the vast majority don't even bother to vote in it. The vast majority don't even bother to vote, or let alone they don't bother to vote in the executive elections. And of course, there are those other ways of getting involved in trade union activity. And I think we should bear that factor in mind. But it's that unfortunately, it does appear that at least in the UK, many UK workers see trade unions as a kind of assurance society. They don't necessarily see it as a membership organisation, and by being an active member, you are the voice of that union, if you're actively involved in it, learn the structures, and also influence the structures, implement rule changes, and so on and so forth. There are many ways to get involved. So I just wanted to make that point as a slight counter argument. It's not just about the bureaucracy, it's about our own activities as a society within those groups. Thanks.
Yeah, can I just come back on a couple of things? Sorry. A couple of things. First of all, Mark's question about how did they manage to drag all those millions of people out of poverty? Well, the answer to that is that the Soviet economic system is progressive relative to capitalism. There's no doubt about that. You know, the rate of industrial growth under the USSR for decades, until the 80s at least, until the late 70s, I should say, was actually far in excess of capitalism. You know, it was about 7% a year or something like that. And that reflected the fact that certainly in terms of assimilating existing productive relations from elsewhere, it could apply them on a massive scale across a whole economy. Whereas under capitalism, it's done in a fragmented way by different companies and enterprises and whatever. It's not done in a planned economy-wise manner. And therefore, you know, it is progressive. You know, statified industries, etc., in a workers' state are progressive, no matter what the deformations of the workers' state. But that doesn't mean that the workers' state cannot be destroyed by those deformations. As we saw, the Soviet Union was eventually destroyed by those deformations. So it's still very contradictory, you know. And those deformations are important, and you have to understand, try to understand and analyze them, and get to the root of the problem. And I think this is what this is all about, really. Just on the question of trade unions that Paul raised and the non-involvement of many members, but that's because of the relatively privileged position of the working class in advanced countries, I think, you know. They don't see unions as very necessary in many cases. People who've got a reasonable standard of living see the unions as quite a minor element of their life. Whereas if they're in a much more oppressed situation or exploited situation, in where there are, you know, for instance, in many many developing countries, you see powerful trade unions that are much more militant, because those workers actually see the unions as their lifeline in a way. They see them as an instrument of actually maintaining what they can achieve, the gains that they can achieve through struggle. That's not been true in the West for a whole period. In fact, it's always been mixed. That the basis of imperialism and its support in the working class was always, to a degree, that phenomenon, that idea that we get wealth, our countries get wealthy as a result of exploiting other parts of the world, exploiting the colonial countries and the semi-colonial countries and whatever, and part of the working class is a beneficiary of that through better standards of living, better welfare, all this sort of thing. So there's always been that element in the imperialist countries of workers who don't see trade unions as essential, or see trade unions as means of actually, trade unions, for instance, that support the arms industry. They're actually no, it might not be very obvious, but you know, in the end, people mustn't realize that what they're doing is they're saying, oh, we can get bet more other people's expense. You know, we are maintaining our standard of living at the expense of the people of the countries that our government will invade or oppress or whatever. You know, there is an element of that sentiment in the working class movement. It's the basis of particularly the right wing, you know. So that is unfortunately the case in imperialist countries, and it's still a big problem, you know, and dealing with that is some of the stuff that John was raising about the role of Leninism and the role of the party, and dealing with these problems. I think it's complex, but that is the underlying issue, is imperialism and its ability to buy off part of the workers' movement in advanced countries, you know. And I think that issue has not really changed. It might take different forms as time goes on, but it hasn't really been overcome, you know. And it probably won't be overcome till we get a revolution in advanced countries, you know. The getting there is not easy, you know. Sorry, John, you wanted to come back. You're muted though.
No, I was just going to say, I agree with what you're saying about, imperialist countries. And that workers can be bought off, there's no doubt about that. And I've been a long advocate about the labour aristocracy in the imperialist countries. But that's the interesting thing of the period we're living through at the moment, because what really woke me up was like the doctor's strike. I mean, I'm going off the subject a bit here, but excuse me, the doctor's strike, right? Because I remember at the beginning of the junior doctor's strike, the doctors were saying, can we not afford to pay doctors this and this amount? Can we not afford? And basically, the British ruling class's reply, from what I've observed, is we're not going to pay doctors. That's gone. And that privilege of being an imperialist country, right, for the doctors is now gone. And if you can get better conditions elsewhere in the world, the fact is that the British ruling class have sent out a clear signal that they are building a different type of health system in Britain, and that includes not having the doctors in tow as they always did, and it shifts, and now it's shifting to a point where in Britain, in the British case, they're attacking. They're willing to attack sections of the privileged middle class that they weren't before, and they're saying, they're not only attacking them, but they're saying to the rest of the population, look, we're going to build a different kind of health system than the one we've had on the past. And if the doctors want to earn their money, they either go abroad to get better conditions, they can go abroad, or two, is going to be private where they can earn their money, not in the state sector anymore. And that's a really interesting development.
Yeah.
And why the British ruling class have come to that conclusion, they've obviously looked at the facts and figures and decided, well, no, the doctors can't be on board all the time. They can't feed their gravy train anymore.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's true. That is an indication that the things are changing and that imperialism is becoming hollowed out by neoliberalism, which was attempting to save it from its own decline. It's hollowing out the whole apparatus of privilege for parts of the middle class and the upper layers of the working class. So it's actually undermining the material basis for things that we've seen in the past. And it's likely that that will be that therefore what we're saying will find much more resonance in the future. I think I don't think it undermines the methods of Lenin. I think it really reinforces them, but they can't exist in all. They can't be effective in all circumstances because there are counter tendencies in imperialism. And that was always true. Hollowing out. It's a way of describing it. Hollowing out the former relations of the labour aristocracy and whatever. I think that's true, Is there anything else substantive we need to discuss today? Because it's getting on a bit. It's getting close. It's actually gone 6 o'clock. I'm just thinking, I just wanted to make one point about the next chapter of this book, which is the chapter on the Soviet Thermidor. I think it's got three subheadings, and they are all very substantial, So I think we should study the first one, which is why Stalin triumphed, at the next one. And they should probably study each of those separately, because they actually are a good discussion in themselves. They're fairly self-contained. They're theoretically interesting. And I think they will each make a good sort of topic for one of these discussions. That's just my suggestion, anyway. I don't know what people think. or if people have even looked at it. I spent a bit of this morning reading through that chapter. I thought, blimey, this is quite substantial stuff. And it would make a really, some two or three really good sessions. Is that agreeable to comrades?
Yes.
That sounds a good idea, except to say that I myself, I'm unlikely to be at the next one, unfortunately, because I think I've got a family event coming up.
Oh, right,
But
okay. Yeah. But we'll try and record it anyway. Hopefully this recording will work all right. I'll have a look at it this evening and see what comes out of it. But is that okay with comrades? Because it is getting on a bit now. It's already been 2 hours or whatever.
So, Ian, have you concluded? We do of the number five. What we do is, do we split it in bits?
Split it into three. I think we should split it into three. There's three substantial passages, which would each make a good subject for a session in itself, I think. It's not like this chapter, which was fairly self-contained and easy to actually encapsulate in one talk. I think you'd have to go through that. You'd have to do these separately, really. And it would be fruitful because you could obviously they overlap to a degree, but you can reinforce it as its educational value is that one will reinforce the other without being the same, so I think it'd be useful to do it that way, if that's agreeable. Okay. Can we wind this up then? And just one question, is there any other business? Is there anything else that's important to raise right now?
When do we meet again?
In 2 weeks' time? Is that okay? Okay, comrades, this has been a really good meeting. And I'll see you in 2 weeks' time, if not before. Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
Cheers.
Bye,
Bye.
bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.